Hello, and welcome to Well I Know Now, the podcast in which I talk to people affected by dementia in all sorts of different ways. I'm Pippa Kelly. My mum lived with vascular dementia for the last decade of her life. She's no longer with us. But one of the main things that mum's dementia taught me and my family was just how little we knew about it. Now, through my work as a dementia campaigner, I know so much more about this incurable condition, not least that the smallest things can make a huge difference to those with dementia and their families and carers. I called this podcast after a quote from author and poet Sylvia Plath, who wrote, "Well, I know now a little more about how much a simple thing like a snowfall can mean to a person. Dementia teaches you this too." My guest today is very special. For a start, she has consistently beaten the likes of the late, great Glenda Jackson, the world-renowned soprano Leslie Garrett, Sir Tony Robinson, aka Blackadder, distinguished academics, medics, writers, musicians, comedians, dietitians, and individuals living with dementia to the number one spot on my Pop Pickers podcast chart. But of course, this is not what makes her so extraordinary. That is down to who she is and what she's done and continues to do. She is Susie Webster, mother, daughter, wife, and for many years carer to her mum Barbara. In 2012, after Barbara developed dementia, she and Susie's dad Gordon came to live with Susie, her husband Andy, and their two girls in Chepstow. When I first met Susie over a decade ago, I was struck by her quiet determination, her love for her family, and her wonderful way with words. I can still remember her telling a conference that her parents had moved in with her and her family so that they could have the dementia adventure together. So simply put. Yet behind the phrase lay the endless reserves of love and courage that those of us who have followed Susie and her mum's story have witnessed over the years. Today, Susie joins me for an unprecedented third time. And there is a sadness to this episode and a reason why Susie is joining me once again. For late in 2022, having weathered the dangerous and turbulent years of the pandemic, Barbara died aged 75. Her death has inevitably left a massive void in her daughter's life. Who am I now? What do we do without her? I began to grieve more than one mum. I missed holding her hand as the little girl on the school run as my go-to person in my young adult life, and her warmth as the constant presence in our lives as her dementia progressed, Susie told me. Adding, "Does that make sense?" It absolutely does, Susie. And I'm sure it will resonate with many listeners. The death of a mother, a mum, your ma, touches places deep inside us, exposing emotions we didn't even know existed. At least that's what I found. And I'm pretty sure I'm not alone. In fact, whenever I talk to Susie, I know that I'm with someone who really understands, who knows what I went through with my mum. And I think that's why Susie has proved such a popular guest, because others feel this too. Susie and I are here today to talk about her loss, but also her future, her hopes and plans as she enters a new chapter of her life. So, Susie Webster, my friend, welcome for the third time to Well I Know Now.
Oh, hi, Pippa. Wow. I feel like I'd like to ring you every week just to hear all of that again. Thank you. What an introduction. Lovely to be here again. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really, I've been looking forward to this in a different way from how I normally look forward to podcasts, because it really is a chat between two friends, this one, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, hopefully it's going to be an informative chat, but no, it's a very special one, this. So my first question is the absolutely obvious one of how are you, obviously, and I was going to ask you, sort of painful as it is, but if you could just, because you're so good with words, talk us through your grief a little bit, this grieving of more than one mum, which I completely, completely understand. And I thought as I was thinking about our chat that perhaps in order to do that, which will be interesting for so many people, I think, could you just tell us a little bit about how it actually happened, how your mum died?
Yeah, of course. I mean, wow, yeah, what a huge gap in our lives, and yeah, what a terrible time we've all been through. Yeah. But again, Pippa, I try and find, you know, the cracks of sunshine that came yeah. through even at that time. But yeah, what happened was actually quite traumatic for us as a family, and very difficult to talk about. And I really appreciate it when you say how good I am with words, because what I'm not good at is writing things down. And I have been encouraged over the years to try and journal and keep a note of, you know, all of this journey that we've been on, but I'm not good at writing it down. So I'm incredibly grateful to have had this opportunity to talk to you as a friend, but for your podcast as well over the years, because it's a kind of record of that journey that I wouldn't have captured in any other way. So I'm really grateful for being, you know, number one podcaster with you. And, you know, that's really special to all of us as a family. But
you're very eloquent. It's fascinating that, you know, it doesn't come out in the writing bit, because you're very eloquent when you talk.
Yeah, I've always felt a bit guilty about that, like wanting to have been able to record things more than I have. But I suppose when you're in the midst of it, the last thing maybe you want to do is write it. I'm also dyslexic, so writing isn't easy for me anyway. So to have this kind of record, you know, I'm revisiting things now, you know, nearly 18 months on from mum's death, and thinking, blimey.
No,
that happened
I'm
as
very
well.
aware of that, and at any time we can stop, you know, I am aware.
I know, I trust you and the listeners and feel like I really want to sort of finish the story off a little bit for people as well.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
I mean, the most traumatic thing happened when I received an email from the care agency. So mum was receiving three visits a day. So six carers were coming every day to help support mum live at home. She was by then in palliative care, so we were receiving support from the hospice as well. You know, we knew mum had quite a large care package compared to perhaps other people, and it had grown as her dementia had progressed, really. And everything was, you know, going along like it had been over the years, you know, bumps in the road. But we were, you know, trying to stay very true to what we'd all decided as a family with mum when she was able, was that she would like to die at home. That was in the advanced care plan. That was in, you know, all of our plan. And very sadly, we received an email, and it was just an email from the care agency to say that they were pulling out all of the carers, and they gave us 7 days notice. That was the
and
email.
how long had you had this care agency? I mean,
For years.
Gosh.
six, seven years. Really close. Knew the carers inside out, you know, very much part of, some of them particularly very much part of the family, because they loved mum, you know, and dad, and seeing the girls growing up. So
how extraordinary.
It was a huge blow.
What lay behind it?
A number of things, I think. New manager coming in, maybe wanting to assert herself, maybe the pressures that care agencies are under to, you know, produce care packages out of thin air with no particular care for funding, or, you know, pressure on discharges, and, you know, all of the things we all know about. But for us as a family, I mean, an email like that during
devastating.
The day I was in.
Yeah,
was
just out of the blue, which is so common, isn't it? You're going about your life and then this thunderbolt hits you.
It was like that completely. In fact, I just went to a complete panic attack and sat on my bed, because I work from home. So I sat on my bed just crying and thinking, how the hell, what the hell, and who do I tell? And I couldn't tell my dad. I couldn't. So I contacted our social worker immediately, and she'd received the same email, and she was so angry that this had happened. But, you know, still at that point, even though it was traumatic, I still thought, I can put it right. I can put this right. This is just a stupid email that's been sent, and it's all probably been sent to the wrong person. I don't know. But, you know, we were told that the care agency was short-staffed, and that they couldn't manage a care package the size of mum's, which they had been doing and were doing that day. So I don't know, Pippa. There was, I'm sure, more behind it. But I knew when I told my dad, and I didn't know how I didn't know how he was going to take it, but actually he took it like my dad, and he took it like, it's okay, we're going to get through this like we get through everything. Whereas I thought he was just going to be really angry, and he wasn't actually. So the social worker, I heard her car screech around the corner. She was round here within minutes. She always was. I mean, she has retired now.
What was her name?
Anna Bansal. Well, she's incredible. Mm. Always walked beside us through this journey. You know.
Exactly what you need, isn't it?
And always remained incredibly professional, very reactive and supportive. Mm. But that day you could see it in her face that this was different. And my dad said, what can we do? What can we do to sort this out? And she said, Gordon, there is nothing you can do.
Why couldn't they just reduce the number, if anything? Why did they have to stop?
Exactly. She contacted them. She tried. My dad tried ringing the office. No one would take his calls. Mm. So it was, I knew then that this was serious, that in her face I knew, oh gosh, this is real. Mm. This is, how the hell are we going to, also Elsie was right in the middle of her GCSEs.
Oh, perfect.
My eldest daughter. Mm. So again, thinking, how am I going to tell her? Couldn't look at my mum, couldn't go in the same room as my mum.
I was going to ask you, I didn't want to interrupt the flow, but it's probably useful for people to know, what stage is your mum at this point? I mean, is she speaking? Is she eating herself? Is she, what stage is she at now?
Able to be moved from her bed to the chair, a recliner chair, still very much in the room with us, with her smile. An odd word now and again. Elsie's, one of Elsie's favourite memories is when my mum said, "Chishiashish," when Elsie was doing her GCSEs.
Oh, right. So, I was going to say that.
So she kind of, she had an awareness of what was happening. In the middle of our family, as always.
Wonderful.
She was needing help with eating, with drinking. Mm. It was 24-hour care, without a doubt, like it had been for some time. Mm. But now the recognition that the palliative care was starting to be supported as well. So we knew things weren't getting better, as always, but still very content and very happy living here. So the thought of trying to move her to somewhere else when she hadn't left our house, Pippa, only to come into the garden on a nice sunny day. So she hadn't been any further than that since 2019, also because of the pandemic, we couldn't use the day service or anything. So
and she lived with traumatic. You since 2012, so by then that's 10 years.
And that, obviously Elsie's doing her GCSEs. It was all that we knew. It was our normal family and our normal family situation. So for someone to throw a grenade into that was, and I tried working at that time within a charity in Wales. I'm well connected, I guess. So I spoke to the regulator, I spoke to Social Care Wales to try and see if someone could help and stop this that was happening to us, and nobody could help. And it really made me question advanced care planning, personal wishes, family wishes.
What's that worth at that point?
We had no rights. We had no. My mum had no human rights.
No, shocking.
The social worker worked really hard, and the care agency then agreed to give us 21 days.
Did they ever speak to you? Was it just
no? No,
they
wouldn't
speak
to us.
They were too cowardly to actually speak to you.
They were, the manager was, because the carers were still coming, obviously, and they were crying. They were distraught. They didn't know what was happening and why it was happening. So that was really
I hope the manager's listening to this.
I do too, because I've never been, I've made a formal complaint. All the things you do, they've learned lessons, apparently. Hooray. But I still feel, I feel a lot better. I'm less angry, but this wasn't the plan. And for anyone who's listening that has followed our journey, it was about mum being with us, and then
totally
to have that. I always had in this back of my mind, maybe one day mum won't be able to live with us, and maybe one day it'll be too much, and maybe one day she will spend the end of her life in a care home, and I felt okay about that because that would have been our choice.
Absolutely.
And that was what was taken from us, and we felt powerless. And after everything, that was a lot to take.
Well you've done so much.
So on the day we moved mum, I mean, you know, she was in so much pain.
Where did you move her to?
She moved. So the other really difficult thing is, you know, with pressures that care homes are under, there wasn't a care home in our area that could take mum who had that level of need. And I was really pleased that care homes were honest about that and didn't just think, well,
money.
We can fill a bed. But also that was pretty scary then, because we started to have to look outside of Chepstow, outside of Monmouthshire. I do know a lot of care homes through my work. I was starting to think, oh gosh, right, do I contact one that I know in Swansea, in Bridgend, in Newport? And then I contacted the charity that I'm a trustee for, Alive.
Yes.
They work with many care homes, as you know, in the Bristol, North Somerset area, and said, I really need some help. Is there a care home, you know, near us? And they knew of somewhere. They couldn't recommend it, of course, but they knew of somewhere that actually meant it was just across the Severn Bridge for us, about a 20-minute journey. And we managed to get mum a room there. Which was and such a brilliant care home. So
thank goodness for that.
I know. We couldn't have coped with anything less. You know, we just we needed her to be safe and well cared for, and that's absolutely what we got with Glebe House in Almondsbury. Which, so big shout out if anybody.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Oh my gosh, because they, you know, mum needed a lot of care. They didn't know her. They didn't have the contact with the care agency that you would have liked them to have had, you know, to understand her personal care needs and things. But they were incredible with us and with the girls and with my dad.
Brilliant.
And importantly, with my mum. So, but on the day that she moved to Pippa, you know, it was the most horrendous day. And she never spoke again. She never smiled again. Not like she used to smile. And that was taken from us. So she lived at the care home for 3 months before she died. And, you know, she was probably dying anyway. I know. But, you know, I think that shortened her life, that move. She didn't want to be there. She didn't want to be there.
No.
So that's...
No,
you know, we made the best of it and we smiled our way through it and we laughed a bit and we cried a lot and we tried, but it's to see her unhappy was, quite a sad ending, really.
Could you see her unhappy?
Yeah. I could see it in her eyes.
So she sort of knew. I mean, she wasn't...
She knew.
Yeah.
She knew. Imagining it from her point of view... She didn't know where she was. She didn't know who anyone was.
Terrifying, really. Yeah.
Absolutely terrifying. And and us popping in and out of that. And, you know, I could see in her eyes. That,
how absolutely devastating.
Yeah.
For you all. That's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really awful time. But, we, you know, we get through, and, you know, mum had the most beautiful end of life. She was so well cared for with complete kindness. And we were involved in everything. The communication was amazing. You know, the GP surgery that became mum's GP was much better than the one we had here. So that was good. We had really good open communication with the GP that understood you know, that mum wasn't to be resuscitated, that there'd be no hospital admissions, no flashing lights and pumping on her chest, and, you know, and that was fully understood. And we were given choice on how much we wanted to be involved, and we weren't made to feel like we were in the way or that we weren't there enough. We were able to be the family that we were here at home. We were able to feel like a family again. So that, you know, again, there's always good things in the bad.
That is really important, all of that.
Yeah. And when it came to, you know, Mum dying, which she did the day after my birthday, which was terrible timing. But, you know, she stayed with me for my birthday and then died on my birthday, Boxing Day.
She died on Boxing Day, did she?
No, on my I'm an only child, Pippa. I've got to dine out on my birthday. So I have a birthday eve, a birthday and a birthday Boxing Day.
I was going to say, I know she didn't, but I was thinking, what is she on about? I'm with you. Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah, so I had said to her, and this was always our humour, now, Mum, don't go dying on my birthday. You know how important it is.
Well, she didn't, to be fair to her.
She didn't. No, she didn't. But, yeah, not the birthday I planned. We were able to be with her. I had a good word with her and said, it's okay. It's okay to go, Mum. You know, I spoke about everyone in the family and how they were, what they were up to. You know, Mum, Dad will be fine. He's with us. We all live together. That's what you wanted. He'll be fine. Elsie's finished her GCSEs. She's learning to drive. Anna's really loving her drama and acting. You know, Ann is fine. He's in his new job at the hospice. And I'm all right, Mum. I will be okay. And you can't live in this pain any longer. It's okay to go, Mum. And she went within a few hours of that little chat. So no painkillers, no ambulances, no anything. She just slipped away. Wow. Release for her. What a lovely ending for us. And I couldn't cope with any more trauma. So no. I was, again, like, wow. If you could paint a perfect death, that. Other than being with us at home, it's okay. We would come to terms with that, you know, and actually knowing that the undertakers were going to be with Mum, you know, not here in this house, maybe that was okay. Maybe it was okay that her body was taken from the care home and not from here. That might have been, I don't know. What do you know?
I know exactly what you mean, and I think you take these slivers of comfort where you can, and actually it does sound like the most amazing death.
Yeah. I wasn't with her, Pippa. I wasn't with her. It was 2:30 in the morning. So I'd come home, I'd gone to bed, knowing that the care home would contact me if anything happened. Not to contact me to say, your mum's dying, come across the bridge immediately, but to let me know if anything happened. We knew it could be 3, 4, 5 days of Mum being very, very ill. So I came home, I went to bed, the phone rang about 3 a.m. to say, Susie, your mum has died. I said, okay, what shall I do? What do you want me to do? And they said, nothing. It's okay. You don't need to do anything. And I just stood at the window of my house for a couple of hours, actually, knowing that her body would be coming past at some point on this road outside our house up to where the undertaker's is. I never saw that happen, but I felt very comforted to imagine her journey across the bridge back to Wales and past our house, you know, and sort of waited up until trying to get to a reasonable hour of about 6 o'clock before I went in and told my dad that she'd gone, and then the girls. So yeah, and of course Andy being there with me the whole time. And again, I've forgotten him off the end of the list, but he was there when the phone went. And yeah, it was nice to have that time with Ann before anybody else knew.
I have a real sort of strong picture of that in my mind. I'm rendered a bit speechless, to be honest. I'm thinking of that. Yeah, have you standing by the window? That's really moving, Susie, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we both need to take a moment. Actually, I find it extraordinary you can't write, because you paint such a vivid picture of these moments. You know, it really catches you. Also, I didn't know any of this. I think purposely I didn't do my normal very deep dive into it, so that I'm sort of well across what people are going to say most of the time. I thought, no, I won't, which I'm beginning to think maybe a mistake.
I probably would have said it differently, though, and certainly if you'd asked me to write it in an email, it wouldn't have sounded
No, writing in an email wouldn't. No, that's true, actually. No, that is true. But I'm being a bit caught by it myself, which isn't very professional. But anyway, yes. So you didn't feel you wanted to immediately dash to the room?
No.
Yeah.
Mm. I think I had such a lovely end conversation with her. Yeah, and that was triggered actually by Elsie and Andrew. We'd spent all day with Mum at the care home. She wasn't really conscious. She was sort of a bit rattly, and the nurse at the care home, I said, what's going to happen, you know, because I didn't know, I've never seen anybody dying, I didn't know what to expect at all. And she said, you know, you'll start to see the colour go from your mum's feet, and you know, we were starting to see that, you know, a bit like a lava lamp sort of the changing of colour. So we sat around the bed, we laughed and cried and watched crap telly, and the carers kept bringing us really lovely cheese and tomato sandwiches, which we'd just demolish, and then we'd go for a walk around the little village, and I know Andy went to the church there, and it's sort of about 4 o'clock that afternoon, we were like, I don't know, what should we do? Do we sit here? Do we? And we just decided to come home and have a bit of a rest. And then later on, round about 7 o'clock, Elsie said, Mum, I want to go back to the care home. I want to see Ma. And I said, oh, Elsie, you know, I think we've done a lot today. We all need to get our rest. This could be quite a few days where we're back and forth, and maybe we'll just, you know, have a takeaway or something tonight. And she said, Mum, I want to go back. So Andy said, well, I'll go with her. Do you want to come? And if I'm really honest, Pippa, I didn't. I didn't want to go again that day.
I understand
day,
that, yeah.
But I didn't want to miss out either. And that's, I'm being completely raw and honest about that. I just thought, what if they're the last people to see her? And I know they'll both listen to this podcast. And
no, I know exactly what you mean.
I just thought I have to be the person at the end with them and supporting Elsie and holding the family up like I'd always done. I had to do that. So we went back to the care home then and spent a couple of hours with her. And that was, you know, Andrew saying, is there anything you want to say to your mum? Because he works, he's a chaplain in a hospice, you know.
Wise man.
Very wise, and, you know, very good, I felt, at not being too worky.
Yes, difficult for him. Yes, it is a day job, isn't it?
I will have a word with him about that if he does. I'll say, you know, you're talking to your wife, not a client or a patient. And, you know, it was very wise words, and it triggered that ending conversation with her.
Which
and
was
I think
so
she
important.
Needed to hear it.
Yeah,
I think she needed to know that we were all going to be all right without her. You know, she was never anyone for a fuss. She never discussed her dementia. She wouldn't have wanted us all there holding her hand at the end and, you know, for the girls to see her like that, I don't think. So I feel completely at peace with the ending. And I feel so, so sad for people that don't have that.
Yes.
I don't know, honestly think it would have been the end for me if there'd been more trauma following the move. And I feel very, very peaceful about it.
Yes, that struck me, because I did send you a few questions, and you said, because you're so honest, that one of the emotions you had was, and as you put it, an interesting sense of relief. And you also said, it was over and I had no sense of guilt, no regrets, just peace.
No.
Yeah, I've put in capital letters beside that. This is interesting and important, which it is. And I remember, and other people around the country and the world, in fact, who listen to this, I'm sure will be having, well, obviously some won't have been as lucky as you and I have to say, in both cases, I did miss, like you. I think it's very common that you miss the actual death. It's almost like people wait, don't they, until you're not physically in the room.
Yeah.
But yes, because I nearly didn't go to visit my mum the day before she died. And it was my husband who, she says through gritted teeth, speaks wise words sometimes. And
they won't be listening to this, don't worry.
One has to bank on it, doesn't one? And he said, you know, because it was Christmas Eve, you know, he said, go, because think, you know, if this is the time, go. You'll never, never forgive yourself, and you won't be able to live with yourself. And what wise words, because she went the following day, and I got there like 5 minutes too late on the Christmas day. So it was incredibly important that I sat there. And, you know, in our cases, it's famously kind of, I've said so many times, but we listened to Nine Lessons and Carol. So, yeah, that became hugely important to me that we'd done that. So I completely understand for you to have a lovely, not conversation, but to tell your mum, it's so important. It's that sense of a sort of completion of it all somehow, isn't it? And I completely understand that. And like you, I too felt, you know, I'd done my best. Not like you, I just bow down and worship at your feet what you did. No. But, you know, we're all different and you do different things. And
I think sharing my journey like I have done, mainly with you like this, but I would never want anybody to feel that we were superior to them. You know, we are all so different. And the timing of things just fitted right for our family. You know, mum moving in with us, the girls growing up as mum was growing down, you know, where I was in my life, where my dad was, what mum wanted, how Andrew supported and, you know, agreed with the decisions that we were making. It just worked for us. And I just think it's so unique. I really do. I would really hope that people don't feel that we're superior in that way. We just did what we did for the time that we did it.
Absolutely. And yeah, you've always been at great pains to say that, which is wonderful of you and totally typical.
It's I think it's important to say that, because, you know, I feel like I've got no guilt or regret, and that I know people live with horrendous guilt, and you can't, you know, dementia is such a challenging and difficult condition, and it goes on for ages, and it's, you know, we have so many, you know, I've tried to bring all of the joy and hope and everything that we had during the time that we cared for mum, because that is equally as important, that we know we gave her the best life possible, and, you know, we learned from her, and we're different people because of her. My girls have grown up different adults. Elsie's an adult now, Anna's not, she's 15, but they're different children for looking after my mum. My mum, the gift that my mum gave us was more than anything she could have ever done without her dementia. And, you know, I'm a different person now, Pippa, and I know Andrew is, and we still would have wanted to have had a life without dementia, of course, but there was many, many things that it gave us that I think people forget. They see the person with dementia slumped in a chair, but the people are so much more than that, and their gifts can be given to you in so many other ways. So I think when I spoke at mum's funeral, I wanted to really get that to come across, how important she was to us, and her story and her as an individual was, she wasn't just someone to be looked after. She was looking after us too.
That's beautifully put. I mean, beautifully put. And how did you craft your speech at the funeral? What else did you say?
Oh, in true Susie Webster style,
didn't write anything down. No.
Didn't have a clue until I stood up there and started talking. I knew I wanted to do something. I've stood on stages at Dementia Congress in front of 1,000 people, you know, and spoken about my mum. This was the least I could do, was to stand up in front of those closest to me and my mum and say a few words, even if it was harder than anything else I've ever done in my life.
Of course, it would have been,
thought, oh, do you know what? I don't really need to do this just before, and thought, no, come on, you can do this. So I had, like I tend to think about what's my beginning and what's my end. So I had that kind of crafted in my mind. And actually, I remember very little about it now. So this morning I said to Elsie, I'm speaking to Pippa later.
What should I say?
I know she's going to ask me, can you remember anything I said at the funeral? And she went, you said something about Ma being like our centre forward in football or something like that. Mm, I said, is that really all you remember? But what I do remember saying, and the thing that I really, really wanted to say, was that my mum lived for those girls. My mum lived for Elsie and Anna. And, you know, even when she was very poorly at the end, when she was living here, you know, her eyes would light up when they came home from school or from college. She knew when they were around, she wasn't going to leave them until she knew that she could. And I think, you know, they prolonged her life. They made her life worth living. I think me and Andy and my dad added a bit to that too, and friends, other friends and family as well. But it was those girls that my mum got up in the morning for. And and I know I said that at the funeral. And I know I looked straight at them. And we had a very, very small funeral. We had lots of people wanting to come, none of whom really knew mum, you know, and knew the story of mum. And for me, it wasn't about them and it wasn't about the story. It was about us huddling together, our very, very close friends and family, and being able, I wanted the girls to be able to cry at the funeral without people looking at them or without thinking that they didn't want people to see them cry. I wanted them to be able to experience the funeral and say goodbye. It was so important. So they did. And in fact, sort of halfway through my speech, I looked up and looked around and thought, oh no, everybody's in complete and utter tears. It was like, I thought, like, there must be somebody that I can look at that's just going to make me not cry. And there wasn't anybody. Even my dad's friend Chepstow Dave was crying. So it was,
if Chepstow Dave is crying, then
that is the sign of a good speech. Yeah, so it was, you know, we didn't even have a lot of family. We had the people that have been through this with us, you know, continuously supporting and caring for mum, and that they were the people that were in the room. So when I did do my speech about her, you know, it was for them. It was definitely for them.
Yes, I was just thinking there, because I often wonder what it is about people that make them, trying to think of the right word, because charismatic is far too flippant and it sounds very superficial, but powerful people that I really want to connect with. And hearing you talk there, I did say it in the intro, actually, you are very determined, and you're quietly determined because you don't, you know, make a big thing of it, but actually you know what you want. I don't mean that in like a selfish way, but you're quite clear about things, I think, in your, you know, as you were talking, I thought, you may not have sort of crafted this speech, good on you, by the way, because actually that's going to be a very, very personal, you know, from the heart speech. So just to have your beginning and your end, I think, is a perfect way to do it, just to know where you're going to land eventually, kind of thing. But actually, just as you spoke then, I thought, but you knew exactly, you knew what you wanted. And then you just quietly set about ensuring that that happens. And whether it be your mum, you know, and you and your family having the dementia adventure together with her living there, or whether it's who you have at the funeral. And I can imagine there were a lot of people who will have thought, we know your story, we want to come and pay our respects. They will have done it with the best of intentions, but you thought, no, this, you know, I love your phrase, we were going to sort of huddle together. And it is a time for hunkering down and huddling together in your grief, in this very, very raw state that we don't very often feel, hopefully, sort of thing, in our lives. It's very powerful. And it can be very, there can be something almost wonderful about it. As you were speaking, I thought, I remember those times, particularly with my dad, actually, of this coming together. And yeah, so yes, that's, I think, well, maybe that's what I recognise in you, this sort of strength. I don't know if you feel I've got that a little bit right about you.
I'd like to think so. I mean, I think I'm a complete overthinker and quite
so am I. So maybe that's why we get on.
Yeah,
total overthinker.
I'm very introverted, extrovert, really. You know, I can do this if I need to do it. I think through mum's illness, I've had to put myself forward. I've had to say no. I've had to say, oh, you know, this isn't right, you know. And the worst, not to go back on it too much, but the feeling that powerless when that decision was made about us knowing that mum couldn't live with us, that was the worst part about it. Just thinking, gosh, there's nothing I can do. I can't be determined and make this, there's nothing I can do. And we, you know, so I think I'm becoming more like that. And this is what I've been, when I responded to your email, one of the things now is, who am I now? Because I don't recognize all of those things in me. You know, that's not who I was before mum's journey with dementia. I was quite placid, quite, oh, yeah, should we do that? Yeah, okay, that, you know, I didn't really, I would just bumble along quite gently. Very sort of Phoebe from Friends, my friends used to call me, because I'd just sort of in the background going, what are we doing now? So I'm starting to look at that and think, you know, have there some choice here on who I want to be now? Because dementia is so much of who I am and so much of my identity, who I have become, you know, because the girls were little girls when we were growing up with mum. So, yeah, it's a bit of a turning point now, I think, on making some decisions about, yeah, who am I? What do I want? What do I need? How do I let some of that go? Because I don't need to fight everybody's battle anymore.
Exactly.
That's quite a nice feeling. You know, I don't have to. I could never talk about dementia again and run to the hills and think that was just a part of my life. But what I've had to do is get some counselling and some really good support around that. And you know what I've realized is that dementia is so much part of who I am and my identity that I can't run for the hills, because it's not right. I want to continue to support people living with dementia and their families. I want to be part of the movement that we hope is going to improve the lives of people living with this condition. It's too important for me to let go, but I want to be able to do that, Pippa, where it doesn't take everything out of me. I'm not fighting every battle on every corner, but I am still part of the change, and I do that in a way that is meaningful and not because I'm an angry ex-carer or because I didn't get everything I wanted for my mum. Nobody gets everything that they want. It's a journey that can't be explained, really, but I still feel there's enough juice in me to, like you, continue to do your bit to raise awareness, to highlight, you know, what was good as well as what wasn't so good, and how, like you said right at the start, sometimes it's the littlest things that make the biggest difference.
Well, you're going to be amazing. You're going to be absolutely effing amazing. You really are. I mean, interesting. Everything you say is always incredibly interesting. And also, I've got all my questions here, and you just wonderfully sort of answer them all without me having to say anything, because I've got all these things. mention that. Now your mum has gone, and as you say, that some of that anger, some of that constantly firefighting, the motion of it, because it's your mum, when that recedes a bit, then you'll almost be more powerful, because you can give all your formidable strength and power to, you know, going outward. You've done that. And what's always struck me about you, Susie, is that you've managed to do that so articulately, so eloquently, while you're going through it. I did say that when I was looking through my notes of previous podcasts, I made that point that I don't think I've ever come across anybody who is able to express as clearly. And it seems quite simple language, but it's beautifully put, at the time they're going through it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't have done, and I meant to be a wordsmith, but when I'm going through it, I'm sort of consumed by it. But you were able to do it, which is incredible. And now you will have so much behind you, and everything before you, and you will be able to do anything, really. And I'm so pleased, selfishly, that you have decided you're not going to run for the hills. Because I did a double take when I said, I can't remember what the question was, but you said, you know, the caring role does define me, because so many people say the opposite, you know, I'm determined that the caring role won't define me, which I completely understand. And I was one of them, you know, it's like, I talk a lot about my resentment that I felt during the time I was caring for my mum and my dad. And I'm so not you, Susie. So I did sort of like think, well, my whole life and all my plans have completely gone out the window. And I didn't articulate it at the time, as I say, not like you, because I'm not as clever as you to be able to do that at the time. But afterwards, I realised there was a deep resentment there, and I had to have counselling to get that out of me. But you have acknowledged that it does define you, and in a way, you still want it to, because you've so much to give.
Yeah. So the job that I've got now, I'm the lived experience coordinator. It probably suits me very well. That's with Dementia UK. And I think that even before I applied for that job, I thought, am I ready for this? Do I want to do this? How can I hold the lives of people living with dementia and their families in any way until I've worked out really if I have the strength to do that, and I'm not going to just bang on about my story all the time. And that was when I, like I said, I got a little bit of help with counselling to kind of really pick that apart. And is that a reaction to mum's death and wanting to save the world from dementia? Mm. Or is that a pure feeling of I've still got stuff in me where I can do this? So, and the conclusion was that I can still support people to tell their story, perhaps similar to the way I've done that, you know. Mm. And I'm not saying that everything I've done was right in that way, but you know, I've got some top tips in there. I've got some, you know, really good ideas around caring for yourself after you've stood on a stage and given your story, or spoken to a member of the press, or tried locally to change services. So I wanted to test that out really on my, when I was really lucky to get the job, and I've made sure.
I think they're really lucky to have you. Can I just interrupt there?
Thank you. But my manager, Gail, has been incredible, because I've been really open with her about that, saying, you know, this might be a bit too much too soon. This might not be, I need to have a lot of support from you to check in with me that, you know, this is still landing okay with the people that I'm working with. And she's done that, you know, and she's been, the whole team actually, well, the whole of Dementia UK have embraced this, which is a brand new role. And it's a real commitment from our chief executive, Hilda, to say that we cannot run a charity without hearing the voices of people living with dementia and their families. Mm. So we need somebody in-house that we know can support that voice, you know, to influence and advise us on what we're doing, right from fundraising to policy. So everybody within Dementia UK has access to our lived experience panel and our lived experience network, so they can check in, you know, are we getting this right for you? Are we going in the right direction with a new strategy coming up now? You know, people with dementia are right in the middle of that, and that's my role, and it fits me perfectly. It's within a charity that really cares, which is, you know, I couldn't work for a charity that didn't have shared values. And I see it right across the board in Dementia UK, that real, it's all about the care and support post-diagnosis.
Absolutely. So for people, I'm sure everybody will by now know, but Dementia UK are the charity that most wonderfully help, support, train Admiral nurses, these incredible dementia nurses who we wish there were more. There are now, their numbers are growing, aren't they? Almost exponentially now, Susie. How many are there, do you know, at the last count?
Oh my gosh, I think it was something like 444, something like that, 450.
Still way, you know, not enough. But really, in the years that I've been in this sector, which is 10 years now, it was stuck at 100 and something, I think, when I first got to hear about them. So that's really impressive, because it'd been stuck at 100 and something for 20-odd years. And now, in the last years, it's really increased. But does your role include trying to increase these numbers and spread the word about these Admiral nurses who are dementia nurses who go into families and I mean, it's very difficult to explain what they do, but they are God-sent miracle workers, lifesavers, aren't they? And get families through very difficult times, often at crunch points. Is that part of your role?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel so passionately about it. It has to be. I mean, the way I describe it to people is if mum's journey with dementia was drawn in a line, I can absolutely pinpoint the points in that journey where if we'd had someone that we could have relied on that was a specialist in dementia care, that really understood us as a family, that was the most important thing, Pippa. We had never had anybody to support the children. Mm-hmm. We never really had anybody checking in emotionally on how we were. It's all very practical. What can we do? What can we throw in to help you? And those, what I used to call the bumps in the road, were the times where, oh my gosh, if I could have picked up a phone and spoken to the person that I knew that had had that relationship with us, that could have helped Elsie through her GCSEs, could have been there when Anna, you know, didn't know how we were going to get mum in the car to get her to the care home. How someone there for my dad, you know, who's never really had anyone to talk to. And for me and Andy as a couple, you know, so they are an incredible resource. And I know how much difference an admiral nurse would have made to our lives. So, yeah, part of the role is keeping that awareness going, because still not enough people know what an admiral nurse is.
Everyone
knows what a McMillan nurse is.
They don't. You know. They don't. I'm going to be very controversial, but I have got a podcast. I'm going to say that I don't think the name helps.
Because no, absolutely.
It doesn't have anything to do with dementia. And I know the story behind it, and it's a sweet story behind it, but it means nothing. When I used to speak to people, they say, is it something to do with the insurance company?
Yes, yeah, or something to do with the Navy. is another one that people... So I think Dementia UK working really hard to get that awareness out there. So Dementia UK, the home of specialist admiral nurses, dementia nurses. So, but it's really long sentences to put into marketing, things like that. But yeah, I mean, hopefully it will grow the more we talk about it. But, you know, what's brilliant about my role is that, you know, I'm supporting people with lived experience to input into admiral nurse training. You know, they're hearing from people living with dementia as part of their academy training as well. So there's, I feel very, very lucky to be working within a charity like that.
I think they're very, very lucky to have you. And you have another role, don't you, with another, well, I think you have more than one other role.
Yeah. So I was still working for My Home Life in England. So providing sort of group coaching facilitation for care sector leaders. So it used to be that we worked mainly with care home managers, but now we're expanded our roles so that we can work with other care leaders. So I'm going to be starting a new program of leadership and development with a group of domiciliary home care managers in Liverpool in February.
Great.
So, yeah, so I've never worked with a group of home care managers solely. As you know, I've got some experience of having home care services.
You could say that.
Which will be helpful, I think. But also, wow, what incredible job they're doing out there still, you know, after COVID, picking themselves up and continue, you know. So if we, you know, as part of My Home Life, can support the leadership and development of those leaders who rarely get much of a word in or on any agendas, then that, again, a fantastic job to have. Other things I'm doing, I'm still a trustee for the famous fantastic charity Alive.
Yes, brilliant. I know, I hoped we'd come back to that, explain to everybody. And one of my very early blogs was on Alive Activities, I think it used to be called.
Yes.
So Alive Inside is something completely different. Everybody forget that. you tell people what it is.
Yeah, so it's an incredible charity that I've been involved with for, oh my gosh, well over 10 years now. The support quality of life for people living in care homes through activity, but also much more than that now, provide meeting centres for people living with dementia in the community. So growing number of meeting centres now, which is a new offer that they're working to yeah, fabulous. I've been to one, went to one fairly recently. And, you know, when you're in a good place, when you're there for about half an hour and you don't know who's living with dementia and who isn't, because it's about community.
Absolutely. I was saying talking to somebody else about it and explaining what that is. A wonderful feeling when you genuinely don't know.
Yes. And it's nobody's separated. Yeah, or put in different
you're just
places.
All having just, good fun or whatever you're doing together.
Yeah, and it was, really, really fantastic. So, yeah, lots of stuff. They've got this incredible empathy suit at the moment, Pippa. I don't know if you've heard of this.
They've bought one, haven't they? Yes. What, to give you the idea of what it would be like to have dementia?
Yeah, or to live with impairments. So if you're unable to pick up a knife and fork. So I've not had the chance to have a go in it yet, but I know it's being really well used in training and producing some brilliant outcomes for particular care home staff and home care staff, sort of understanding what it might be like to get a 15-minute call when, you know, you need a bit more time than that. I'm always in awe of everything they do over there. They're
fantastic.
Yes,
and we ought to mention Tim, oughtn't we? Tim Lloyd Yates, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was an incredible chap who died far too young, who set it up. I mean, the most amazing man. Amazing man.
Yeah.
And so it lives on. Yeah. It lives on in it.
Lives on in everything we do alive. You know, the check-in is what would Tim do?
Right, brilliant.
It would probably be completely bonkers. So we don't always do what we think Tim might have wanted us to do. But we are so lucky to have Isabel Jones, who's the chief executive. She's been the chief executive for a few years now, and she's been with the charity from the start. Knew Tim really well. So yeah, there's no doubt that the heart of this charity is still very much intact, and she's taken it to places perhaps Tim couldn't, because I think Tim was so keen on delivery and being out holding up the hands of people living with dementia, and being in the care homes. That
he was very hands-on, wasn't he?
Very hands-on. And as a chief executive, you need someone who can step back and go, okay, let's try and manage this brilliant thing. She is brilliant. We're really pleased to have her. So, yeah. And then other things, obviously, over here in Wales, still very much involved with Cleishai Dementia, which is a group of people living with dementia and their carers that are the voice that sort of influence practice and policy over here. So
what's it called again? I didn't catch that.
Oh, it's Cleishai Dementia. Please don't ask me to spell it.
Okay, no,
but
as long as I don't have to say
I will put it. I'll put it in an email for you. But
I'll put it in the show notes. Yes.
They're a campaigning group that we've been involved in the hospital charter over here, considering the needs of people with dementia when they're coming into hospital, being in hospital and trying to leave at the other end. I've been part of that as well. So again, shout out to them. There's so many brilliant people doing so many brilliant things.
I'm always telling people that because it gets such a negative rap. And actually there are so many people who are... much overused word, but they literally are so inspirational and they're doing incredible work. I know, and other people, you know, the public just don't know about them enough.
No. And it sometimes feels like you're knocking your head against a brick wall. And, you know, one of the biggest learnings, I think I've probably even said it today, is that you can't fight every battle, but, you know, do fight a couple at least, because without the people with lived experience, nothing will change. It's the stories. I think the really good example of the post office scandal was, until it came to our TV screens through storytelling, nothing changed. And I'm really passionate about people being able to share their story, supported to share their story, because that's when people listen. That's when it matters. And
absolutely,
that's what you do with your podcast, is putting it out there as a story so that that people want to engage with.
Absolutely, and you do it phenomenally well. I've just seen the time, so we must draw this to a close. I had a feeling we might just be able to talk and talk and talk. And you and I will meet up over a glass or two of wine and talk and talk and talk some more, because there's even more things on my list, but I think that's long enough. And the only thing I'm going to end up really by saying is that I was absolutely delighted, because when you did send me back some answers to my rather lengthy list of questions that I send people. I can't remember what the question was, but anyway, you said in your email, we did a great job of caring for Mum. We were extraordinary. Mm. And actually, as you were talking earlier about, you know, what the way that your mum's dementia has changed you all and how you've done things that you wouldn't have been able to do before. And that came to mind, actually. And I thought, yes, brilliant, because you really are extraordinary. You just have to accept that, OK? I mean, I'm not breaking any argument with that. And I think that we're, you know, very fortunate in the dementia sector and families with dementia that you are out there, Susie, and that you've decided to continue doing what you do so well. And so all power to you as you go forward now,
Thank you.
In your life, and continue to make the world for people with dementia and their families, and, you know, for people without dementia, just, you know, anybody, you just make it a better place. You do.
Thank you. I really tried not to talk about individuals that have supported us as a family, because I'm definitely going to miss someone off.
Yeah.
So I know, because like my Eurovision friends who, Pippa, they set up a little GoFundMe to help me, because the other thing I haven't mentioned is that the price of the care home, you know, we were looking at selling the house, because it was, you know, we couldn't afford it.
Well, that is a subject we should have covered, actually, yes.
Yeah, I just thought about that then. So my Eurovision friends all got together and they would just put in what they could afford once a week, just, you know, £2, £5, and that, you know, that really helped.
How brilliant. Susie Webster, for anybody who doesn't know, is a huge... I mean, this is her only failing, actually, as far as I can make out.
You won't say that this year when we bring it home again. We've got Ollie Alexander. It's all going to be good.
I'll believe you. I'll believe anything you say, Susie. But how wonderful. You have this crowd of friends through that and through your sort of extraordinary love of Eurovision Song Contest. But how brilliant, how wonderful.
Yeah, people are...
What did your cold swimming group do?
Yeah, well, they just let me be in the sea. You know, that was the only time I really felt like I was on my own.
Yeah.
Even though I was surrounded by lovely people that were all enjoying the freezing cold, you know. No, that's okay. I won't try and persuade you on that one. But I think for me, seeing just a length of sea in front of me and knowing there was space in the world, because I often felt so claustrophobic and like everything in this house is my, I've got to sort it out. I've got to, that was the place where I went, where I thought, gosh, do you know what, Susie, you're just a little dot on this world. You know, everything is going to be okay. And I, you know, even when I still swim now, I feel my mum, she wouldn't have come in with me, but she's around me and she's probably laughing at me. And we did have a Eurovision song at her funeral, by the way.
I've got the image of you swimming and your mum's with you. What a lovely image. And what a lovely image for you as you go forward as well, swimming into that sea in front of you, that ocean.
Yeah.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you very much for having me again.
This last podcast was less a podcast than a chat between friends on which you've all been eavesdropping. I decided not to probe too much for information before I spoke to Susie, to let our conversation evolve very naturally. And as a result, I was caught off guard once or twice. The image of her standing by the window in the early hours of the morning, looking out, waiting for the hearse to pass and her mum to return from over the bridge back to Wales, was so haunting, very beautiful. I don't know about you, but hearing the final chapter in Susie's incredible story of caring for her mum brought back so many memories for the final years of my own parents' lives. It touched me, resonated with me, and moved me. One of Susie's abiding messages to us all is that people with dementia have so much to offer us. Their gifts can be given in so many ways, she said, and I loved that. And now Susie has to rediscover who she is and look to the future with hope. I'm so glad that she's decided to use her experiences to continue to work to support those whose lives have been impacted by dementia. This will be the next chapter of the warm, caring, often hard, but always loving story of Susie, her mum, her family, and dementia. Susie mentioned several organisations. The charity Dementia UK, which supports and trains specialist dementia nurses called Admiral Nurses, you can find at www.dementiauk.org. My Home Life can be found at myhomelife.org.uk. The wonderful charity Alive can be found at aliveactivities.org. And finally, Cleisiau Dementia in Wales, which is actually spelt LLEISIAU, dementia, can be found on X, formerly known as Twitter, where their hashtag is at CleisiauW. And finally, if you've enjoyed listening today, I would be very, very grateful if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform or channel you're listening to it on, as this will help spread the word about the podcast, and then together perhaps we can further diminish the stigma, increase the knowledge, and quash the myths surrounding dementia.